point out very quickly, before we start, some of you may have seen President Bush came out with the federal government's proposed budget for next year. Following our discussion on Medicaid last week, I just brought with me the Times report of the budget proposal, in which Robert Payer of the Times wrote last week, Mr. Bush also proposed savings in Medicaid, the federal state program for low income. He proposed savings for a total of $783 million next year and $13.6 billion over a 4-year period. Mr. Bush said he would achieve most of the savings. This is the way he's achieved most of this $13 billion, $14 billion savings over the next couple of years. Most of the savings by limiting the ability of states to shift Medicaid costs to the federal government. So obviously, we discussed that in class last week. Still, a key issue for federal policymakers, interestingly enough, obviously, if he saves the Fed $14 billion by limiting the ability of states to shift Medicaid costs, it's not necessarily to save Medicaid money, although it might. Let me just say a word about the memo I sent, about the policy memo that's due the next time we meet. You know, next week, February 20th, there is no class. President's Day, I know you all very upset, okay. You know what I'm saying? We come back February 27th, and on February 27th, at the beginning of class, I'm going to get the policy memo from you. We're then going to break up into groups in which we're going to discuss in 12 smaller groups, at the bottom of about 20-25 people each week. We're going to discuss proposals around the uninsured. But having heard the lecture tonight, having done the reading, and then having written a memo on the uninsured, I think you'll be well prepared to have that conversation. For the memo, you've all been assigned to take a different perspective. And I think you all should have gotten both a copy of the email, and the memo was also on coursework, so for whatever reason you didn't. And you'll notice we divided you up by alphabetical order into 12 groups. Each group takes a different perspective. Group one is the federal government from the president's perspective. Group two, the federal government from sort of a liberal democratic perspective, Ted Kennedy. Group three is the National Government Association. Group four, as somebody pointed out to me, there really is no National Association of Local Public Health Departments. It's got a different and longer name, county and city health officials or some such thing. But the idea for group four is really to take the perspective of local public health departments and local cities and what they think should be done around the uninsured. Group five is a large insurance company, in this case Aetna. Group six is a large big business, General Motors. Group seven is a big union, the AFL-CIO. Group eight is the Chamber of Commerce, which really represents the interests of small businesses in the United States. Group 9 is Families USA, which is one of the largest consumer advocacy organizations, so we take a position, sort of an advocate position on behalf of the uninsured. Group 10 is the AMA, Group 11 is the Hospital Association, and Group 12 is the Community Health Center Association. So for the memo, and then I laid out some guidelines for the memo. For the memo, you take the perspective, you're writing, in effect, the memo, you work for that organization or that company or that politician. And you're writing a memo to the head of your organization setting forth a legislative strategy or a legislative proposal from your perspective. What the problem is, and I try to lay this out, what the problem is, what the issues are, what the background is, what the options are, what the pros and cons of the options are, and what you think should be done realistically from your perspective. When we meet on the 27th and you go into smaller groups, you're going to go into groups with everybody from group one will assign you to a particular room. In that meeting, you don't have to take the position of the federal government from President Bush or the federal government from Ted Kennedy. In the small group session, you're going to just have a more general conversation around strategies for the uninsured. And I'll send you a little something about that over the next week or so to sort of guide you with some questions that I want you to come out of that meeting trying to answer. But that's the plan around policy memo and the breakout sessions. And then on the 27th, half of the class session will be the breakout session. and the other half all the discussing the Medicare Modernization Act. And then after that, by the time we then get into early March, we'll actually move away from issues of insurance and start talking about managed care and delivery system issues, both in the private and public sector, and then long-term care and public health and on and on. Any questions about any of this? Yeah. Sure. Local governments, depending on the state, are very involved in Medicaid. They're not involved in Medicare at all. In New York State, for example, the state requires the counties, or the local governments in New York State, to pay 50% of the non-federal cost of the Medicaid program. And so counties around New York State and about 12 to 15 other states in the country have to pay a significant chunk of the Medicaid bill. And of course, the way counties raise revenue is through their primarily through property taxes. And so as Medicaid bills have gone up, local counties have been raising property taxes significantly in recent years. And so in a number of states, there's a real relationship between property tax, Medicaid, and the uninsured. More generally, and in particular for those folks who sort of are writing a memo, say, from the perspective of local public health departments, local governments, as we've talked about in the very beginning of the century, local governments in the beginning of American history were the ones who really were the ultimate safety net. They're the ones who operated public hospitals, who provided health care and welfare benefits to the deserving poor, who really were in all the last line of defense for the uninsured. And so I think when you're thinking about from, say, the city or local perspective, these issues of these uninsured, it's really from the perspective of some of a organization or a government entity that has to operate public hospitals, have to operate a welfare system that takes care of the uninsured in the final analysis. All right, so let me talk a little about the uninsured. I'm going to spend the next few minutes just giving you some basic facts, which you've got in the readings anyway, but I just sort of will lay them out to set the stage for the discussion. As the readings make clear, there are now 46 million folks who, at any given time, at a point of time, are uninsured in the United States. Over a couple of year period, there were probably 80 or so million folks who've been uninsured at some point during that couple of years. People have insurance when they don't have insurance, when they have it, when they don't have it. But at any given time, there's about 45 million that lack health insurance. That number has increased by about 6 million from 2000. So over the last five and a half years, the number of uninsured has gone up over 1 million a year. So the problem is getting worse, not better. There are also, in addition to 45, 46 million who are uninsured, there are also anywhere from 16 to 20 million or more, it's hard to count accurately, folks who are underinsured, who have health insurance that simply does not cover in any realistic or significant way the health care costs that they actually incur, either because the deductibles are too high or the caps are too low or the benefits are too minimal. For whatever reason, their needs are not met, they incur a significant out-of-pocket cost in a given year. So lots of folks are uninsured in the United States, and the number is getting bigger all the time. Who are those folks? Well, just a couple of things, and again, there's more about this in your reading. Most of the uninsured over 80% of the uninsured are in a family in which there's somebody who's working in that family. I think the number is about 69% of the uninsured are in a family where someone has a full-time job. Even with someone having a full-time job, that family does not have health insurance. About two-thirds of the uninsured are in families that are relatively low income, have income at 200% of poverty level or below. The rates of uninsurance are especially high among minority groups, particularly Hispanics. About a third of all Hispanics are uninsured in the United States, and about 20-21% of African Americans are uninsured. Yeah. Yes. To the extent that estimates can be made. There is extraordinary variation among the states in levels of insurance. There are some states, this gets exactly to your point about undocumented immigrants, such as Texas, California, Arizona, which have uninsurance rates in the 25-26% rates. About one out of every four people in Texas lack health insurance. It's a pretty remarkable number in 2006. Conversely, in Minnesota, about 8% of the population lacks health insurance. So you really have, again, a tremendous variation from 25-26% in Texas, California, et al., to 7-9% in Minnesota, and a handful of other states. Nationally, the number is around 16%. Again, there's more demographics on the uninsured than some of the materials that you have. But, you know, the basic picture is relatively low income, working class families, lots of minorities, high numbers in four states, lots of young adults. And lots of variation across the board. Why is the number going up? I mean, why have we gone from 40 million uninsured in 2000 to 46 million uninsured today? And the number keeps getting worse over time. Well, clearly the biggest factor is that while we still have in the United States a health insurance system that is predominantly one in which Americans get coverage through their employer, the employer-based health insurance system is under siege. Fewer and fewer employers are providing health insurance to their employees. More and more employers are raising the co-pays, or the amount of money, the share of the premium that the employee has to kick in order to access that health insurance. And for many relatively low-income folks, even if they are offered health insurance by their employee, they choose not to take it up because they think they can't afford it, and probably they can't afford it. More and more employers are hiring more and more part-time workers and independent contractors and not covering family dependents. So the rate of employer-sponsored insurance is declining. Again, just to give you a couple of numbers. In 2000, the year 2000, just 5-6 years ago, 69% of all employers in the United States offered health insurance to employees. In 2005, that number had dropped to 60%, a 9% drop in 5 years in the number of employers offering health insurance to employees. Back in 1999, 72% of all Americans had insurance through their employer. That number was down to 68% in 2005. So the number with private health insurance, the number of employers sponsored have private health insurance is declining. And while programs like Medicaid and SCHIP, Children's Health Insurance Program, are making up for some of those losses through expansions in public programs, the public programs cannot expand fast enough to stay up with the erosion, with the decline in the private insurance markets. And that's creating a crisis. And of course, why are private employers dropping health insurance left and right? Clearly the answer has to do with cost. What's the average cost of a family policy right now in the United States? Roughly, anybody know? I couldn't have two people. $4,000 for family plan, $4,000, yeah. About $11,000. Costs about $11,000 a year on average. Now that's not a particularly expensive or rich plan. That's an average plan for family of four. I mean for families in the United States. Now about $11,000, right now the employee is being asked to pay about $2,700 of that $11,000. The employer picks up the difference. Your figure of $4,000 is actually right on the mark for individuals. That's how much it costs for an individual to buy an individual-based health plan, having nothing to do with family. That number has been going up double figures for the last year, for several years, for lots of reasons. We'll talk about costs later. But as costs go up, employers are dropping health insurance, the number of uninsured is rising, and things are getting worse and worse. What's the impact of not having health insurance? What's the impact of not having health insurance? Let me ask you. What difference does it make? Some people would say, here's sort of the argument that some people say, oh, it's not so bad not having health insurance. Why is it not so bad? You know, there's these public hospitals, there's these community health centers, there's these health department clinics, there's a safety net. You could just show up when you need to show up. You can go to the emergency room, you can show up, and you won't be left to die in the streets. We have the safety net, yeah.
As people go to the hospitals, the fees go up for people who are in this insurance plan, so the premiums increase for them, as well as the cost of the state to have to cover this.
So clearly one thing that happens is there's a lot of cost shifting in the system. When indeed people do show up at the emergency rooms that don't have health insurance, and when indeed they're unable to pay their bills, as often happens, the hospitals will often try, to the extent they can, to shift some of their uncompensated care losses to the private payers, to the private insurance companies, and so some of those costs are shifted. Yeah.
People only go for acute care. They don't go for preventative, like, care. So the disease stage is way later than...
So clearly, there's also a significant amount of delaying and foregoing of needed preventive care. Yeah.
There's a lot of non-emergent care given in the emergency room,
which
keeps away from those
who really... Emergency rooms, you show up in an emergency room, sometimes you can sit 8, 9, 12, 14 hours because you've got in that emergency room, particularly in a big city, you've got families in which kids have sore throats, and so they show up in the emergency room. They use the emergency room as a primary care facility. Of course, not only is that expensive primary care, therefore leading to more uncompensated care for the hospital, therefore leading to more cost shifting, therefore leading to all sorts of trouble. But it's also inefficient from the patient and from the doctor's perspective too. And in addition to that, a lot of those folks don't show up, you know, for the primary care at all. And people end up in hospitals with conditions, you know, because they're having an attack, they have asthma, they end up with an attack, or diabetes, they end up with an attack, where if they've gotten good primary preventive care, they could avoid those hospitalizations. Yeah.
But there's also a significant population of people who go to the emergency room who are covered by private insurance and yet still go to the emergency room as if they're the primary care physician. But a lot of Medicaid patients who are covered for these things will still go to the emergency room if the kid has an ear infection or a sore throat. So it's not just the uninsured.
The comment was, for those who couldn't hear it, there's lots of folks who use the emergency room as a primary care facility, including lots of folks on Medicaid and low-income folks more generally, and that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. So insurance alone isn't the only obstacle to access, and insurance alone isn't the only obstacle to good primary care. That's absolutely true. But basically, folks without health insurance don't get the primary care they need. They don't get the specialty care they need. Maybe they could show up at the ER. But if they've got cancer or if they've got some sort of specialty care needs, they don't get the chemotherapy or the ongoing specialty care. They don't get the prescription drugs they need. They end up in the hospital for services that often could have been avoided with good primary and preventive care. They get billed. You know, if you show up at the hospital and you're uninsured, you'll get a bill. I mean, the hospital will definitely send you a bill. And that bill, amazingly enough, will be significantly higher. You don't get a break because you're uninsured. In fact, your bill is higher if you're uninsured than if you have insurance. Because if you have insurance, the insurance company has negotiated with the hospital and has gotten a relatively low rate, has gotten a discount. So insured folks and insurance companies pay discounted rates. If you're uninsured and you show up at the ER, you'll be billed at sort of the going market rate. The hospitals will then often send those bills to collection agencies when you don't pay. Hospitals end up not collecting a lot of those bills, and again, as we talked about trying to shift the costs, but consumers and the uninsured will often end up in bankruptcy. You know, in personal bankruptcy because they can't pay those bills and the collection companies can't collect. So big problems both for the individual and the consumer and the provider, big problems all around. So it's a big problem, has real implications, getting worse. Again, as we pointed out, insurance alone is not the answer. I mean, in the article I had to read in the cover book by John Billings, and I forget who wrote it with him, but by John Billings, pointed out all of the other kind of obstacles to good access, but clearly insurance does make a big difference. Now, there have been, and we began this discussion a few weeks back, there have been efforts since the beginning of the 20th century to try to expand government's role in ensuring and requiring and encouraging health insurance for most Americans. We talked about Teddy Roosevelt and Roosevelt's efforts to try to encourage compulsory workers' insurance and how that went down the tubes. We talked about Franklin Roosevelt and how Franklin Roosevelt and his advisors wanted to push for compulsory health insurance, and that went down the tubes. We talked about Harry Truman, and how Harry Truman proposed national health insurance, and that went down the tubes. We talked about how private health insurance emerged in the 1940s and seemed to provide this little safety net, the safety valve for most Americans, and so the debate shifted in the public sector to, you know, to the safety net role, and that led to the enactment in 1965 of Medicare and Medicaid, and we talked about that history. And then, obviously, for the last week or so, we talked about Medicare and Medicaid. When Medicare was enacted in 1965, and you saw hints of this in that video, the Kaiser video that I showed to you last week or the week before, whenever it was. When Medicare was enacted in 1965, advocates on behalf of Medicare believed that Medicare would be followed shortly by national health insurance. That Medicare was the first step to national health insurance. That as surely as morning follows night, national health insurance was going to follow Medicare. After Lyndon Johnson leaves office, Richard Nixon becomes president. What was Richard Nixon's thoughts about national health insurance? Anybody know? Richard Nixon proposed national health insurance in 1971. Richard Nixon proposed that employers be required to provide health insurance to their employees, and that it be an employer mandate, and that government fill in the gaps for everybody who doesn't work. Nixon proposed national health insurance. Why didn't it get enacted? What were the Liberal Democrats? What was Teddy Kennedy saying in 1971? In 1971, Ted Kennedy and the Liberal Democrats were saying they were so sure. Again, remember, Medicare had just been enacted a few years before. In Kennedy's mind, and the Liberal Democratic leadership's mind, the issue wasn't, was there going to be national health insurance, or was there not going to be national health insurance? Indeed, as I said, Richard Nixon was proposing national health insurance. The question was, what form was that national health insurance going to take? And Nixon was proposing an employer-based national health insurance, in which employers were required to provide health insurance to their employees. Kennedy didn't like that. Kennedy wanted a Canadian-style single-payer system, in which government basically expanded Medicare to cover everybody in the United States. So in 1971, 72, 73, in the early 1970s, the debate was Liberal Democrats saying Medicare for all, Nixon and the Republicans saying no employer mandate. Liberal Democrats getting more and more anxious and angry at Nixon over that period, less and less likely to negotiate with him. In the summer of 1974, shortly before he left office, Nixon again came out proposing national health insurance with the idea that it was gonna, that national health insurance could be the policy that would take the attention away from Watergate and would allow him, in effect, to rescue his presidency. Democrats, at this point, sensing blood around Nixon, but also thinking national health insurance was inevitable, did not compromise. Now, 30 years later, you think Ted Kennedy regrets not going along with an employer mandate in 1971, 72, 73? I mean, I've never discussed it with him, but I think he might. I think he might. Richard Nixon proposed in the early 1970s, I don't know how many of you know this, unless I've already said it. I never know what I've repeated, what I've already said and what I haven't, but Richard Nixon proposed that every American receive a guaranteed national income. That there be a national welfare system and there be a guaranteed national income for every American. A radical, radical proposal. No other president in American history has ever proposed something like that. Liberal Democrats opposed Nixon's proposal, not because they opposed the idea of a guaranteed national income, but instead because they thought that the income level that Nixon was proposing was too low, when the Democrats wanted a higher level. And so the debate between Nixon and the Democrats in the early 70s wasn't about whether or not a national guaranteed income was a good idea or a bad idea. Both thought it was a good idea. Pat Moynihan, former senator from New York, was Nixon's chief domestic advisor at the time, and he was pushing this. Got Nixon pushed this. 30 years later, do the Democrats regret not having gone along with the guaranteed national income? Most Liberal Democrats clearly do. It was a different time then. Again, the issue wasn't was national health insurance or was there going to be a guaranteed national income. It was, do we like Nixon's proposal or do we want a different kind of proposal? Window of opportunity closed, though. Watergate happens. Nixon leaves office. Ford comes into office. Ford has a very different view. Window of opportunity closes. Wayne back.
Can you explain how a guaranteed national income is different from
the
welfare?
Well, minimum wage, if you want me to think of an analogy today, it's closest probably to the Earned Income Tax Credit, the EITC that we have today. But back then, well now, it's certainly different from minimum wage. A minimum wage means if you go to work, the employer has to pay you $6 an hour or $7 an hour. So if you don't work, you don't get the minimum wage. Welfare, states and the federal government basically set up rules to say you only get welfare if you're, you know, in a low-income family that's part of the deserving poor. Guaranteed national income would mean that every American, whether they were young, whether they were old, whether they were poor because they were deserving, quote-unquote, or because they were undeserving, would be guaranteed money. And basically, if you didn't work, the government would actually provide, and there are European countries that have these kinds of systems. But if you ended up not working, you would get a set amount of money. It would be sort of like a welfare for all, for everybody, based on sort of a minimal level. And the debate, obviously, was what would that do? And the Democrats wanted a higher level. The Republican opposition to that was that was going to wipe out the Republican opposition was, if we give $6,500 a year, which is what the Democrats were seeking back then, as a guaranteed national income, that would in effect be like giving the minimum wage to everybody who's not working. And as one Republican congressman from Georgia said, well, if we do that, who's going to push those wheelbarrows? You know, who's going to do the sort of, you know, minimum wage, really miserable jobs? You'd wipe out that whole lower level. The Republican proposal and Nixon proposal was for a guaranteed national income that was much lower than that. So it would have been below minimum wage. So you would have at least had some incentive in theory to work as opposed to not work. So that's the basic concept. Okay. But in any event, window of opportunity closes, Ford comes in, then Carter, and national health insurance goes off the agenda through the late 70s and 1980s. Late 1980s, a couple of things happen again now. Late 1980s, number one, there's a spike in the number of uninsured in the United States. Just like in the early 2000s, there's been a spike. Late 80s, there's a spike in the number of uninsured. In response to that spike, and we talked about this when we talked about Medicaid last week, in response to that spike, liberal Democrats, knowing that Reagan and then Bush were in the White House, they couldn't get national health insurance at that point, got through all the Medicaid expansions that we talked about last week. So late 80s, early 90s, the number of folks on Medicaid begins to rise dramatically. Costs for the states begin to rise, there's a recession, there's budget deficits, all the things we talked about last week. But there's also increased attention paid to the uninsured in the late 80s. Because now, for the first time, you're seeing a lot of middle-class folks uninsured. You're seeing a lot of working-class folks who had insurance losing their health insurance when they move from one job to another job. The media begins to pick up the story in the late 80s of the uninsured, really for the first time since the early 1970s. And so late 80s, just about every state in the country. Now remember, the presidency at this time was still occupied by George Bush, Sr., before him Reagan. So not much action at the national level around the uninsured, at least in the executive branch, other than the Medicaid expansions. But at the state, just about every state in the country starts saying to itself, we have to figure out a way to do something about the uninsured in our state. Number one, because the numbers are growing, and it's a real political problem for us. But number two, because we've got to do something about these rising Medicaid costs. We've got to figure out a way to actually save some Medicaid money other than shifting costs to the federal government, because the number of uninsured is just beginning to overwhelm us. And the number of folks on Medicaid is beginning to overwhelm us. So in the late 80s, just about every state in the country created a commission or a task force to take a look at the problems of the uninsured. The idea that was at the top of the heap was basically Nixon's idea back in 1971-72. The idea that was at the top of the heap was an employer mandate. Michael Dukakis, anybody know Michael Dukakis? Michael Dukakis runs for president in 1988, touting the Massachusetts miracle and touting legislation that he got through, which was never actually implemented, but which would have, in effect, imposed an employer mandate in the state of Massachusetts. It would have required employers to either provide health insurance to their employees or to pay into a state fund and have the state provide health insurance to those employees. The model for the states. There is one state in the United States, who knows what the one state is, that requires all employees to provide health insurance. Employers, yeah. Excuse me?
California.
No. California actually last year passed a ballot initiative that would have required an employer mandate in certain businesses, but the following year they repealed that ballot initiative. Yeah. Hawaii. Back in 1974, that same year that Nixon and Kennedy and members of Congress proposed talking about national health insurance, that same year, legislators in the state of Hawaii passed a law which required employers to provide health insurance to their employees in the state of Hawaii. The law affects only full-time employees, people who work over 17 and a half hours, so they don't have universal coverage in Hawaii. But they do have an employer mandate. It's the only employer mandate in the United States today. Now, part of the reason it's the only employer mandate in the United States today is because there's a federal law, which I'm going to say a little bit about right now, called ERISA. How many of you know about ERISA? Any of you? One, two? There's a federal law which actually comes into play here. But go ahead, you had a comment? Right. It is not required of the dependent care coverage. No. Right, so now I'm going to take a little side trip and talk about ERISA. We're going to come back to ERISA in a couple of weeks when we talk about managed care and a bunch of other things, because ERISA is a federal law which actually has a huge impact in many, 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 many ways on the nation's health insurance system. But let me begin the tangent in the following way. After World War II ended, and all the troops started coming home, and they all went back to work in the local factories and the local plants, they were told by their employers, you work for 25 years at the plant and we'll give you a pension. You work for 30 years, we'll give you a pension. Essentially, you had almost an implied contract, or more than an implied contract, between much of the American workforce and their employer, that if they worked for certain numbers of years, they would get a guaranteed pension at the end of that time. During that period of time, there was much less mobility in the United States than there is today. You didn't have situations like you have today where families, you know, like my family, with one sister in Seattle, one in France, I mean, people all over the place. You didn't have that nearly as much back then. I mean, my wife grew up in an 800-person town, farming town in Indiana. Everybody in that town basically stayed there, you know, for generations. Until the last generation, when people started gathering all over the place with torn clothes and all the things happened. But so during the 50s and 60s, basically people expected that they'd work in a local plant, or they'd work in a local factory, or they'd work in a local company, and they'd get a pension. Early 1970s, that first wave of World War II veterans begins to retire. And they begin to expect their pension. Only there's scandal after scandal after scandal, because it turns out that a lot of these companies that were saying they were going to give a pension to their employees were inadequately capitalized. They didn't have enough money to actually pay the pensions of the retirees, or they had all sorts of fine print in the contract, which said you only get the pension after you vest, and you only vest after you work here for 30 years, and lo and behold, I know you've been here for 29 years and 364 days, but we're letting you go. So there were scandals where people did not get pensions that they expected to get. So they began complaining to their politicians, members of Congress began holding hearings and looking into this. Now, at that time, it was the states that regulated the pension industry. And there was a perception that the states were doing a lousy job regulating the pension industry. Just like there was a perception that the states were doing a lousy job regulating the health insurance industry. Just like there was a perception that the states were doing a lousy job implementing civil rights. Just like there was a perception that states were inept and corrupt and inefficient, there was a real backlash against state government in the late 60s and early 70s. And so members of Congress begin looking into this pension scandal, this pension crisis. And in 1974, Congress passed a law known as ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. It's a law that's designed to protect the pensions of the American workforce. It imposes all sorts of national rules on pensions. You've got to have adequately capitalized pensions. You have to notify employees of their rights. You have to have fair vesting rules. All of these rules that the United States Department of Labor enforces about pensions. So you say, well, that's all fine and good. What does this have to do with health insurance? What does this have to do with Hawaii's employee mandate? Well, what happened is Congress, when it was passing this pension law, decided it didn't want the states getting involved in pensions. It was taking the issue area away from the states. There would simply be federal regulation of pensions. And so Congress, when it passed the law, included a provision which said that the states are prohibited from regulating or legislating in any area that relates to an employee benefit program unless that employee benefit program and the legislation, unless the legislation is part of the traditional regulation of insurance that states have always done. So it's a two-part test. First thing ERISA said, the law said, is the states are not allowed to regulate in areas that relate to employee benefit programs. But there's an exception to that, and the exception is, however, the state can regulate if it's part of the traditional regulation of insurance. The idea being, states have historically and traditionally been in charge of health insurance, and ERISA wasn't designed to prevent states from regulating health insurance. So the rule was states can't regulate employee benefit programs, but they can regulate where they traditionally regulated insurance. So in any ERISA case, there's always a two-part test. Part one is the state law at issue one that relates to an employee benefit plan? And if it is, is it part of the traditional regulation of insurance? If the state law does relate to an employee benefit plan, and if the state law is not part of the traditional regulation of insurance, then that state law is null and void. Now let's go back to Hawaii. 1974, Hawaii passes a law saying employers have to provide health insurance to employees. One of those employers in Hawaii is the Standard Oil Company. And the Standard Oil Company doesn't like this law. It doesn't like being told by the state of Hawaii that it has to provide health insurance to its employees. And so the Standard Oil Company goes to its lawyers and says, can Hawaii really do this to us? And the lawyers say, well, we're not really sure, but we have a potential case under ERISA. And so they challenge the Hawaii employer mandate as violating ERISA. So the first question the court has to deal with is what? What's the first question? Does the Hawaii law relate to an employee benefit? And what's the answer to that? Yes, I mean, if you're the state of Hawaii and you're telling Standard Oil they have to provide health insurance to their employees, well, you're regulating an employee benefit. It relates to an employee benefit. Second question, though, is that Hawaii law part of the traditional regulation of insurance? Is it an insurance law? And here's where the court could have gone either way. The court could have said, yes, you know, it's regulating health insurance. That's what states have always done. It's part of the traditional regulation of insurance. You know, you could fashion an argument, if you're a lawyer for the state of Hawaii, as to why this employer mandate is part of what you've traditionally done around health insurance. However, what the court held was that, no, this is not a traditional insurance law. No other state in the country has ever required employees to provide health insurance to their employees, so you can hardly say it's a traditional thing that states do. No state has done it. And the United States Supreme Court held that the Hawaii law was not part of the traditional regulation of insurance, and it struck down the Hawaii law. So the Hawaii employee mandate violates the RFRA. Now, by this time, you know, this case took years to wind and wend its way through the courts. So by this time, it's the early 1980s. I forget what year it was, but the early 1980s, the court ultimately says the Hawaii law is no good. By this time, Hawaii has actually been implementing this law, you know, for 7, 8, 9 years. And so the senators from Hawaii, the congressmen from Hawaii, go to Congress. And they say, you know what, the Supreme Court has just struck down our state law on the grounds that it's violative of ERISA. We don't think that's fair. In fact, our law, the Hawaii Employee Mandate Law, we passed our law before ERISA was even enacted, which they did. So there's a long back and forth, and finally Congress agrees to give Hawaii an exemption from ERISA. So Congress writes into the law that Hawaii is allowed to have its employee mandate. But Congress also writes into the law that no other state could get a similar kind of exemption. And so, when Michael Dukakis of the state of Massachusetts passed a law in the late 1980s requiring employers to provide health insurance to their employees, that law was probably violative of ERISA. It was never tested in the courts because, you know, Dukakis ran for president. He lost. William Weld became president. I say William Weld is now running. I mean, William Weld became governor. I say William Weld is now running for governor here in New York many, many years later. And Weld was a Republican, and Massachusetts repealed the law before it ever was scheduled to take effect. But that law was probably violative of ERISA. California, 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, the voters of California passed an initiative that would have required many employers in the state to provide health insurance to their employees. That law, too, was never tested in court. Because, why? Because the voters repealed the initiative 6 months later. But it was probably, it may well also have been violative of ERISA. We don't know for sure, because Congress hasn't dealt with this issue in over 20 years. However, there's a very good chance, similarly in the early 1990s, the state of Oregon and the state of Washington both enacted employer mandates. They both went to Congress and said, could you give us an exemption from ERISA? And Congress said no. And then they ended up repealing their law. So we've never had a test case since that Standard Oil case to see what the court thinks today, 22, 23 years later. We may well be getting a test case pretty soon. Anybody know what's happened in the last few months that will test this proposition out? One of these pieces happened in the last couple of weeks. What did Maryland do a couple of weeks ago? Yeah.
Went back to Walmart not giving health insurance to like 10,000 of their workers. They passed the law, or trying to pass the law, that a company of a certain size is required to cover a certain amount of health insurance. So if they're over 10,000 employers, then even if they're part-time, then they still have to go ahead and do it.
That's what, I don't know if everybody could hear that, but the state of Maryland, the legislature in Maryland, a couple months back, enacted a law that basically applied to one company in the state of Maryland. It doesn't say Walmart, but Walmart is the only company that meets the description in the state of this law. It basically says, if you're a company with more than 10,000 employees operating in the state of Maryland, you need to spend at least 8% of your payroll on health insurance. There are some other companies in Maryland that have over 10,000 employees, not many, but a few, but they all spend already over 8% of their payroll on health insurance. Walmart does not. So while the law does not mention Walmart, the law is aimed at Walmart. Clearly. It's not like a secret. Walmart has become sort of the standard battering ram of folks who are complaining about big companies, large companies that don't provide health insurance to all of their employees. Certainly large numbers of Walmart employees end up on Medicaid or public insurance programs of one sort or another, or uninsured. There are about a dozen other states in the country that are considering similar laws against companies like Walmart. If you read the articles, the governor of Maryland vetoed the law. Governor of Maryland vetoed that law. But the Maryland legislature had enough votes to override the veto. So that law is now in place. It hasn't actually taken effect yet, but that law is now in place. There's a very good chance, and Walmart now, if you read the comments from the Walmart folks, they're trying to decide what to do. Because option one, they may do both things simultaneously, but on the one hand, they're professing, you know, their willingness to go along, and they're saying, because right now they're somewhere, they're around 7% of their payroll for health insurance, and the estimates are that if they just raise, you know, that if they spend this extra money and comply with the law, they'll cover some more people, and they'll score some PR points, etc. At the same time, Walmart is also, and the lawyers from Walmart are also making it clear that they think that what Maryland did violates ERISA. Just like what Hawaii did 30 years ago violated the Supreme Court held. So it's not at all clear that Maryland can do that. There are other states recently that have been thinking about employer mandates, and there are some cities and some counties that have talked about employer mandates. ERISA is an obstacle or a barrier to all of them. We will talk later about why it's so hard to amend ERISA. You might say, well, you know, if ERISA is such a barrier, why doesn't Congress change ERISA? Why is ERISA so sacrosanct? And there's a lot of reasons for that, but I want to come back to that story when we're doing managed care a little bit later in this semester. Because that's where ERISA really gets, and sort of regulation, that's where ERISA really gets important. Any questions on any of this so far? Yeah. Massachusetts is doing a couple of things right now. I'm not sure about the constitutional I didn't know that, actually. I mean, I know Governor Romney is talking about individual mandate, and there's also a state legislation in Massachusetts law. In terms of constitutional mandate, I don't know. I mean, all of these things would be up for grabs. I mean, I think clearly, ERISA would be challenged on ERISA grounds. Whether or not the fact that it was a constitutional amendment as opposed to a sort of state law, I'm not sure how much difference that would make. I mean, there's been, ERISA law has changed significantly in lots of ways over the last 20 years, since the last case, since the Standard Oil case. in lots of areas that we're going to be talking about later in the semester. And that's why there's a lot of uncertainty today in 2006 as to whether or not the current Supreme Court, regardless of the political composition of the court, but just the current Supreme Court, would rule the same way the court ruled 20 years ago, which is why there are states and there are groups that are saying, let's pass these laws and we think we can survive under the current jurisdiction. And it was a challenge. But I'm not, I don't have the answer to the constitutional ethics. Okay. So states try to do employment mandates late 80s. A number of states do. They go nowhere because of ERISA. The next sort of piece of the story takes place a couple of years later, in 1991, in the state of Pennsylvania. Senator from Pennsylvania, John Hines, former husband of Theresa Hines, current wife of John Kerry, follow the call. But John Hines, unfortunately, killed in a helicopter crash, plane crash. And so the governor of Pennsylvania needs to appoint someone to take his seat on a short-term basis so they can hold an election replacement. He appoints a liberal Democrat. The governor is a Democrat. The governor appoints a liberal Democrat named Harris Wofford to take that seat. Wofford goes into the Senate, but he's only there for a short period of time he's only in there unprotected for a short period of time because under Pennsylvania law, there pretty quickly has to be a special election to fill the seat. Wofford runs as a Democrat in the special election. The Republicans nominate Richard Thornburgh. Thornburgh, former United States Attorney, former governor of Pennsylvania, very popular fellow in the state of Pennsylvania. National figure, popular figure, heavy favorite to defeat Wofford. Heavy favorite to win the election. Wofford, though, has something up his sleeve. And what he has up his sleeve are a couple of political consultants, named James Caldwell and Paul Begalia, who you may know, CNN or wherever you know these days. And this Caldwell and Begalia take Wofford's campaign, and they basically come up and they sense, and Wofford senses, that in Pennsylvania in 1991 you had a large number of sort of middle class folks who were worried about their health insurance. You had a large number of folks who were afraid to change jobs because they thought they might lose their health insurance. You had a large number of folks who were uninsured. And they sensed that this could and would be a key political issue. They came up with an advertising campaign. Who remembers their advertising campaign? Anybody? It was a pretty clever campaign. Basically, they come up with an advertising campaign which says that if you're poor in the state of Pennsylvania and you commit a crime, and you can't afford a lawyer, government will provide you with a lawyer. So, you can kill somebody, and government will give you a lawyer. But if you're working class, and you can't afford health insurance, government gives you nothing. So they have this whole campaign sort of contrasting, criminal defendants' entitlement to lawyers versus, solid, upstanding citizens who are uninsured and go through all sorts of personal crisis. And they ran these ads in a pretty effective way. And the ads resonated with working class and middle class folks in Pennsylvania. And Wofford won the election in a stunning surprise. Nobody thought he'd beat Thornburgh. And his victory was attributed to the health insurance issue. And so all of a sudden, health insurance had really been off the agenda, national agenda, since the early 70s. National health insurance. It had creeped back in the states with Dukakis and some of the other state officials late 80s. But now Harris Wofford had shown that on a national level, a campaign for national health insurance has some political relevance. Called when Begalia then leave Wofford, having gotten him elected to the Senate, and they go to work for Bill Clinton, who's running for president. Carl Gallagher with Stephanopoulos become his key campaign advisor. Now Clinton, running for president in 92, was basically running on a campaign that suggested he was a new kind of Democrat. He wasn't an old-fashioned liberal Democrat. He wasn't sort of a Republican. He was a new breed of Democrat. He believed in markets. He believed in balanced budgets. But he was a Democrat as well. And he believed in things like national health insurance. But Clinton sees that, you know, what happened in Pennsylvania. He hears from Carl McGalley about the resonance of national health insurance, and he quickly senses correctly that national health insurance, it could be a powerful weapon for him in the campaign against George Bush Sr. And so he calls for national health insurance. But again, he clearly defines himself as saying he wants national health insurance, number one, because there's a lot of people who are suffering, but number two, almost or equally as important, because this is a budgetary crisis that's devastating the American business community and devastating the balance, you know, the American budget. And so he wants to deal with both the cost crisis and the lack of insurance crisis, and he wants to do it in this new market-driven way. He doesn't want, and he sort of rejects out of hand, the old Ted Kennedy Medicare for all, single payer, NL approach. Number one, he says that's politically a non-starter and politically non-viable, but it also doesn't resonate with him. It's not the kind of approach he wants. Long story short, jump ahead a little bit, Clinton obviously is elected. He appoints Hillary to run the task force on healthcare, health insurance. While Hillary runs the task force, they pretty much knew what the plan was even before the task force started. The task force was designed primarily to try to build up the support for the plan, which it failed miserably at, obviously. But the plan itself had just a few key components, which I'll just run by you quickly now. Number one, it would have imposed an employer mandate. It would have required employers to provide health insurance to their employees. It also would, and this was pivotal from Clinton's perspective, it would have adopted what he called and what others were calling principles of managed competition. The idea was that you would create what were known as health alliances or purchasing cooperatives. So in each state, say, just for an example, say the state of New York, there would be one health alliance. It would be a nonprofit organization. And the role of the health alliance would be to regulate the competition between insurance companies who would then offer their product to employers and employees. So say you had 50 health insurance companies in New York City. We'll say 500 insurance companies in New York State. Those insurance companies would say, we want to sell this product at this price, this benefit package at this price. Now, if there's a minimum benefit package, but basically, we're going to sell this benefit package at this price, we'll sell the Chevy benefit package at this price, and the, you know, the Beamer benefit package at this higher price. Then the Health Alliance would sort of go through all of these insurance companies' bids, and they would pick out a menu of plans. You know, they would say, all right, all employers in New York State have to offer the following 15 options or 10 options, following menu, to their employees. So there would be some losers. Some insurance companies wouldn't make the cut. They wouldn't get picked by the Health Alliance. The Health Alliance would pick the plan the employees would then pick between these 10 or 15 plans, and they would have, the employees presumably would have a financial incentive to pick a lower cost plan, because if they picked a lower cost plan, their employer would pick up almost all of the cost, while if they picked a higher cost plan, they would have to kick in more of the money themselves. So the idea would be you'd have the health alliance that was regulating the competition between the health insurance companies. The employees would have a fiscal incentive to pick cheaper plans and spend less money, and the whole thing would be hunky-dory. And that was basically the plan. You still have Medicare, you still have government, you know, filling in the gaps for, you know, those folks who don't work. But that was basically the plan. There were a million little, you know, tweaks here and there, including the tweak of the health alliance that wasn't saving enough money through this managed competition. Of course, it didn't come down quickly enough through this managed competition. The health alliance could actually begin to regulate the rates a little bit. But there was, that was the general idea of the plan. Clinton goes on national television, he takes out his little card, he says, this is a health savings card. This plan is good for all Americans, this plan. It's not just good for the uninsured. I mean, clearly it's good for the uninsured, they get health insurance. But it's also good for the 85% of Americans who have health insurance. Why is it good for them, says Clinton? Because they get guaranteed health security. They don't have to worry if they change jobs, they'll lose health insurance. They don't have to worry about their employer dropping health insurance. It's going to be regulated, it's guaranteed. That's the basic Clinton plan. A year later, the plan was completely dead. The plan was so dead that the Republicans take over the Congress in 1994, and Newt Gingrich takes over the Congress and the House in 1994, basically making the argument that Clinton screwed up so much on health insurance, we can't trust him. Hillary Clinton is still making self-deprecating comments on any campaign tour that she makes these days about how, well, you all know I have some experience with health care, and, you know, I had my troubles back in the early 90s. I mean, the plan becomes a fiasco, and it goes down to this devastating defeat. Why? Let me ask you why. What were some of the kinds of problems the plan had? Politically, yeah.
The insurance company paid it.
So one problem, and what I'm going to do is take your comment and sort of put it in a larger framework. One problem is there was tremendous interest group opposition to the plan. Insurance companies, now Clinton knew what he'd get, so he pretty much knew that the small insurance companies would hate the plan. Why was that? Because small insurance companies were going to be pretty much out of business. Because remember, the health alliances were going to pick sort of the winning bid, and the assumption was it was going to be the big insurance companies that were going to be the ones that were going to be allowed to have their wares to the employer, and the small insurance companies would be knocked out of business. Clinton knew he didn't have the small insurance companies. He thought the big insurance companies would support the plan, because he thought they would see themselves as winners under the plan. It was, in his view, this market-based plan that the insurance companies would be winners under. He was dead wrong there. The insurance industry, both small insurers and big insurers, were dead set against this plan. The insurance companies, the small insurance companies were against it for the reasons I just described. Excuse me, the big insurance companies were against it because they didn't want government basically regulating insurance markets in that way. What other interest groups opposed the plan? Yeah.
Small firms.
The business community, the small business community, was dead set against the plan. 75% of the, remember I said that 81% of the uninsured have a worker in the family. The large majority of those workers work for small businesses or they're self-employed. So the large majority of the uninsured are in families that work for small businesses or employed, or self-employed. Health insurance costs a lot more in the small group or individual market for a lot of reasons that we'll come to in a few minutes. Clinton knew that any employer mandate was going to have its biggest impact on the small business community. He said, well, you know, we'll give some subsidies to small businesses so that they could pay for the cost of the health insurance. But the small business community didn't believe it. They didn't believe in the subsidies. They basically, and this is where the United States Chamber of Commerce got involved, though the National Federation of Independent Businesses, the Chamber of Commerce and the like, the small business community basically said, this plan is terrible for us. It's going to mean small businesses are going to go out of business. Joe's Pizzeria, Joe's Pizzeria is not going to be able to afford to provide health insurance, you know, under the plan for his 4 or 5 employees. He's going to have to lay 2 or 3 of them off. You know, and so the small business community was dead set against the plan. And the big business community, again, Clinton knew small business would oppose it. He thought big business would support him. Because most of big business already was providing health insurance to their employees. But the big business community was also dead set against Clinton. Why? Because, again, ideologically, they might be providing health insurance to their employees, most of them, not Walmart, but most of them, but they didn't want government telling them they had to do so. So the business community was against him. The insurance industry was against him. The medical community was ambivalent, and the medical community was, fractured and splintered. The pharmaceutical industry was dead set against him. Liberal Democrats, the Ted Kennedys of the world, supported Clinton, but did so a little bit half-heartedly because they were cynical. They thought, they were saying, this is just a big giveaway. It's kind of like the debate over Medicare drugs last year. They were saying, this is just a big giveaway. I mean, ironically, the big insurance companies were opposing the plan, and so, liberal Democrats were saying, this is just a big giveaway to the big insurance companies because they're basically going to have, have the whole business of the United States in their hands. But liberals, were suspicious because they saw this as a big giveaway to the insurance companies, but they also liked the idea. They learned the lesson a little bit from 20 years before. So they supported, but they were not super enthusiastic supporters. And what about the uninsured themselves? First of all, they only represent 15% of the population. They're generally relatively conservative group. It's a working class population that's not on welfare, that typically politically is not particularly activist and liberal. And they're basically spending most of their time trying to put food on the table. They're not politically organized, they're not politically influential. So the uninsured are pretty much out of the game themselves. And the 85% of Americans that already had health insurance began to become afraid that instead of giving them security, this plan was going to end up giving them less coverage at a higher cost. And so interest groups, whether it was business, whether it was insurance, whether it was drug companies, whether it was citizens groups, interest groups were dead set against him, and there was not a lot of interest group support for him. And so there was, one reason the plan died had to do with interest group opposition. Forgetting interest group opposition, what's another reason the plan had trouble?
ERISA?
No, ERISA actually would not be an obstacle here because remember, what ERISA says is that the state, ERISA was designed to ensure guaranteed federal regulation of the pension industry. So it prohibits the states from enacting the employee mandate, but it doesn't prohibit the federal government from doing so. But another kind of opposition had to do with what you might call, I'm going to put some up the three I's, I guess. One is interest groups. A second is institutions. The institutions of the American government make it hard, say some. There's a very famous article in Political Science called "It's trying to explain why National Health Insurance failed, the Clinton plan failed." It was called "It's the Institution Stupid." During the Clinton campaign, the whole mantra was "It's the economy stupid." Well, this article was said it's the institutions. What do they mean by that? What do you think they meant? What did James Madison make sure that we had in American government? Separation of powers, checks and balances, complicated Congress. So number one, there's a lot of veto points in American government before getting major legislation through. It takes the president like Lyndon Johnson, who's got tremendous political capital to overcome all those veto points. What kind of political capital did the Clinton have in 92-93? What percent, anybody know what percent of the population voted for Bill Clinton in the 1992 election? Excuse me? I couldn't hear. Somebody raise that. I just can't hear, actually. I'm just going deaf. What?
38.
No, it's a little higher than that. 43. Clinton won with 43% of the vote. In fact, there are still many who suggest that if Ross Perot had not run as a third-party candidate, Clinton wouldn't have won. But he won with 43%. So he didn't exactly win this compelling majoritarian mandate as Lyndon Johnson had, you know, 30 years before. Before Clinton even came into office, he was embroiled in scandal. I mean, everything from Jennifer Flowers during the campaign to the Whitewater scandals, you know, to remember right after he came in, there was Travelgate, you know, when Hillary was accused of firing all the travel office. There was, when he was going through the transition, several appointees. I mean, he got his third appointee to become Attorney General of the United States. The first two basically had a lead. And everybody remember Zoe Bair? You know, I mean, he appointed this woman, Zoe Bair, to the United States Attorney General, and it turned out that she'd had a nanny and hadn't paid taxes on behalf of the nanny. And so the thought that the, you know, the leading, you know, lawmaker of the United States was going to have, you know, avoid taxes, she had to pull out. Kind of like, everybody read that Dick Cheney shot somebody? I don't know why. I mean, it's not at all funny. This poor guy's for some reason, you know, it's funny. Cheney out there shooting somebody while trying to hide. I mean, luckily the guy, you know, I guess the guy's alive and okay. And then I started reading the report from the Cheney folks, and they were saying, well, it was really the guy's fault. he hadn't announced that he was coming back and said, I'm here, or something like that. So, of course, Cheney could shoot. Anyway, reading that right before I came to class. So, Clinton didn't have much political capital at all. And he didn't have much political capital. He went through a very tough battle to get NAFTA, you know, the North American Free Trade Agreement through. He went through a very tough budget battle with Congress. And so by the time, the healthcare stuff came along, you know, he just didn't have the capital to make the battle. So institutionally, there were interests, particularly with all the interests with opposition. And then the third eye is ideology. And in my mind, I mean, everybody can have their own opinion as to, you know, why we don't have national health insurance in the United States. There's a book that just came out a couple of months ago. It's an interesting book. I think it's called Why Don't We Have National Health Insurance? I mean, there's a whole millions of these books now. This is actually a pretty good one. And basically, the author argues that it's all interest groups. You know, it's really just these powerful business groups and insurance groups and doctor groups and labor groups. You know, all through American history, it's all interest groups. That's the key thing. If I had to say, and all of these things are important. I mean, interest groups clearly are important. Institutions are important. You know, the fact that they screwed up a task force is important. They have this big, secretive task force that, you know, became politically, you know, a real albatross around their neck. They didn't handle the media correctly. I mean, all this stuff, you know, Clinton is this savvy master politician who everybody calls up for advice politically, but, you know, he totally, totally miscalculated when it came to health insurance and the healthcare state. But to me, the sort of, you know, the number one issue does have to do with American culture, political culture, and ideology. I mean, we don't have in this country a sense of social solidarity that other countries around the world have. And I remember watching Bill O'Reilly a few months ago. Have you watched Bill O'Reilly? So I was watching Bill O'Reilly, and he had as a guest an advocate for a single-payer national health insurance plan. And so, you know, in his sort of gruff way, he starts saying to her, why should I, you know, Bill O'Reilly, who goes to the gym every day, to take care of myself, who's in good shape, who doesn't smoke, who doesn't eat lousy food. You know, I take care of myself. Why should I be responsible for the health care bill of Joe Schmo, who smokes 3 packs a day, who's an alcoholic, who's obese, who doesn't take care of himself? You know, why should I be responsible for the health care bills of those folks? You know, there's this sense of individual responsibility, individualism. You know, and the advocate for national insurance basically starts to say, well, you know, there but for the grace of God, you know, you think you take care of yourself. And it's great, I'm glad you don't smoke, and I'm glad you go to the gym, and I'm glad you're in good shape. But, you know, next week you could be diagnosed with cancer anyway. You know, or, you know, even if you're not, your friends might, or your mother might, or your grandson might. You know, so she began to say, you know, we ought to have, you know, the young should take care of the old, the healthy should take care of the sick. You know, that's just the only way you can have a system in which everybody is taken care of is if basically those who are healthy and those who are young and those who have a little take care of the others. We have a strong American culture that believes in the old adage that we're responsible for ourselves, and that's it. And that if we're young and healthy and we can get a health insurance policy that's a lot cheaper because we're young and healthy, all the better. If someone else doesn't take care of themselves, it's their fault that they're sick. They should be responsible for taking care of themselves. And so we've got, you know, we just have not solved that question of the community and, you know, without getting too kumbayash or whatever. You know, it's not, you know, I don't want to go overboard here. We don't sit around the fire enough. You know, we don't, you know, tell each other how important we are. No, I mean, we don't have that. And that really does make a difference. It really does make a difference. Other countries, for whatever reason, have approached it very differently. But it becomes a real obstacle, I think, because you're asking people to pay more and get less so that other people who they might consider other from them, a different race, a different religion, a different class, a different ethnic background, so that they might get it. And that's, we are a country that's very fragmented, that's very decentralized, that's very individualistic. I think that's a big part of it. But as I said, this really interesting book that came out that says culture doesn't really have all that much to do with it. It's all interest groups and power and money. And it's all economics. You know, so you could think it's, you know, there's no right or wrong in there. There's different theories, but where it becomes important, where it becomes really important, and where you really have to think about it, and we're going to sort of, I'm going to take the question then, we're going to begin getting at options around the uninsured today and what's going on today, and you can talk about this with your group, and you can write memos and do all this stuff. Where it really becomes important is, kind of like another headline I just read today. I was reading, the Republicans came out with this sort of report in Congress and the House, it was pretty interesting, sort of blistering the Bush administration and HHS around Katrina. And so Scott McClellan, who's Bush, guy, asked about this report, and he said, we're not interested in yesterday, we're looking forward to tomorrow, to make it better tomorrow. But the reason yesterday is important is because if you want to begin to try to fashion an argument or a campaign or a thought about, you know, what we should do about, we've gone from 40 million uninsured to 45 in the last 5 years, we'll be at 50 million probably soon, the problem's getting worse, costs are going up. If you want to think about how you deal with the issue, how you deal with the problem, how you begin to develop a political coalition of any sort, you do have to have a sense of what you think the obstacles are you have to overcome. There was a comment, bring it back to me, yeah. Right. Right. The comment for those who couldn't hear at the other end of the room is there are those who say that the fact that we have programs like Medicare makes it much tougher to get national health insurance. And that's clearly also the case. I mean, there's a group, sort of a field in political science, the world of political science, that argue very strongly with what they call path dependence. Now, you don't have to know what path dependence is, but the basic idea is, you know, decisions and programs that have been previously implemented and put in place shape the available paths you have prospectively forward. So, for example, when we were talking about the history of Medicare and Medicaid, it was clear that the Republicans wanted sort of a welfare-based system because they were arguing that that would, you know, if we had sort of a system dominated by private insurance, you can have government as a safety net. And if government fills that role as a safety net, then that undermines the political pressure for national health insurance for everybody. And so clearly you could say that those decisions we've made, the decision to have an employer-based health insurance system in which 170 million Americans do get health insurance, or 180 million, whatever the number is these days, you know, through their employer. 60% of Americans do get health insurance from their employer. That undermines an argument for national health insurance. The fact that, you know, 42 million get Medicare, 52 million get Medicaid, the fact that there's only, you know, 45 million who lack insurance. It was that all these other systems that over time, they have created these other paths to insurance. And those other paths make it harder and harder. So that's clearly, I'm glad you pointed that out, that's clearly a whole other theory and line of argument as to why it becomes so difficult. Because in effect, that becomes, you have to make the argument as to why giving something to this 15% isn't going to make things worse for you. All right, let's take a break, and then we'll come back, and we'll talk about what happened post-election. I think it's a little deli on 159th and Fort Washington, saying that somebody had left a course pack in the class there. They only, you know, had my name on it. And I actually meant to stop by before class, make sure they hold it to me, and I meant to stop by and pick it up. But I forgot to, but I assume it'll still be there tomorrow. But if you forgot your course pack there, and you've just been really, you know, missing it. They are holding it to you there. We also, in terms of the syllabus in this class, I'm hoping that we're going to have, within the second half of the semester, two or three guest lecturers for part of the hours. I mean, like an hour on a couple of different subjects. For example, on April 17th, we have Jeff Sachs is going to come and talk about global poverty and health and issues around that. And then there's a couple other people who will probably be coming at different points. So I'll let you know about the additions to the curriculum for the children as we go along. Okay. Any questions on stuff we were talking about before the break? So. All right. After the Clinton plan goes down to its abysmal defeat, advocates on behalf of the uninsured, I guess you could say, sort of switch gears and begin to focus on more incremental reforms in two different directions. In the mid-1990s, direction number one was to look at and to try to convince state legislatures and Congress to pass laws to make it easier for folks who work for small businesses or who are self-employed to have access to health insurance. So there's a big focus on the small group market. Now, as I mentioned an hour or so ago, health insurance in the small group market and the individual market is significantly more expensive and more difficult to get than health insurance in the large group market. Why is that? Why do you think that is? Why does health insurance cost so much more for small business, little pizzeria than the general market? Yes. So clearly, number one is, you know, when I call up Aetna from Joe's Pizzeria and say, I want health insurance for my four employees, and, you know, the phone rings, and I have to pick up the phone, I put you on hold for a second, and they pick up the phone, and it's know, the employee benefits manager for General Motors or something. I mean, clearly, size matters in terms of leverage and bargaining power. And the smaller you are, the less leverage you have. Absolutely. What else? Yeah?
I'm looking at the fewer employees and
absolutely. Good guess. It's what's known as adverse selection. I mean, you've got the concept of insurance is one which suggests you're going to spread risk over as many people as you can. So the more healthy people you have that you can spread risk over, the lower the cost is, so that if one of your employees becomes sick, you know, you can spread that risk. If you've got four employees and one of them gets really sick, the other three have to pay for that one, in effect. If you have a million employees and 40 get sick, you know, clearly it's a lot cheaper. Yeah?
Can you just explain, like, very quickly how health insurance is done? Because, like, even if you have only four employees, we call it Aetna, the risk is spread among all the people Aetna covers, like, throughout the country. Is it really per business that comes up with the rate?
Yes. Per business, to the extent they can. Now, states, as we'll talk about, have begun to regulate this a little bit. But there's a difference between experience rating and community rating. What you've, and we talked about that a little bit earlier in the semester, what you've just described, why doesn't Aetna just charge everybody, you know, the same rate, would be what's known as community rating. Charging everybody in the community the same rate, regardless of their health status, regardless of their age, regardless of where they live, and the like. Aetna says, we don't want to do that. You know, automobile insurance doesn't do that. You know, if you have Allstate, and it turns out that car accident last year, your rates are going to go up. If they think you're going to cost more, they'll charge you more. They come up with a rate for you as an individual based on what they expect your cost to be all the time. So if you're you're a 17-year-old kid, when my 17-year-old daughter drives to school every day, you know, take some of her friends. It's like a scary thing. But, you know, health insurance for her cost more than health insurance. Car insurance for her cost more than car insurance. You know, cars are like myself. So what insurance companies want to do, if they want to experience rate, and similarly, if there's a group of employees in a business, what does health insurance want to do if they want to give that business a rate for those employees. So if you've got four healthy employees, you can get a slightly better rate than if you have four employees, one of whom's been sick in the past. But if you have a million employees, you're going to get a separate rate. So clearly, in the large group market, you know, they try to experience rate, and it's sort of a battle between the insurance companies that try to, you know, learn as much about you and experience rate versus the leverage that the company has, you know, trying to drive a bargain with you. In the small group market, to the extent they can get away with it, they experience rate. Now, states, as we'll talk about in a few minutes, have been trying to limit the ability of insurance companies to experience rate in the small group market. But clearly, before the 1990s, that's what they were doing a lot of, and that's one of the things states began to act against. Does that make sense? Yeah?
Professor, supposedly you mentioned in what ways insurance companies
I'm sorry, could you...
You mentioned experience
rating,
right?
Right.
Can you mention one of the ways that states are actually telling insurance companies or limiting insurance companies?
Yeah, I mean, for example, a number of states, including New York and other states, have passed laws that require community rating in the small group market that basically say to insurance companies, if you want to sell insurance, small employers and individuals, you have to charge a community rate. You cannot experience. I mean, states have that ability to regulate the market in that way, and some states have chosen to do so. Now, the insurance companies hate community rating and have fought vigorously against it, and so most states don't have community rating laws. So most states give completely allowed to experience rate. But a number of states have tried to impose by regulation community rating in the small group market to get at precisely this problem we talked about. So one reason rates for small group market are higher is that they lack bargaining power. Another reason is you can't spread risk. The third reason is it actually costs more to administer you know, a million small plans with five people each in them than it does to administer one plan with 5 million people. Just there's efficiencies of size and efficiencies of scale. And so, you know, clearly the smaller the group and the fact that you have to provide insurance to lots and lots of different small groups, your administrative costs, your marketing costs, you know, you got to market to all those small businesses, your oversight, your claims department, everything is sort of going to cost more in the small group market. So for all those reasons, insurance costs more in the small group market historically. Unfortunately, the small group market historically also have lower wages than the big group market, large group market. So you've got, you know, self-employed and small business folks who are making less money who have higher health insurance bills. And so you combine those two, it's not a surprise that the majority of Americans who lack health insurance work for small businesses or self-employed or the dependents of such people.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask a question. Are there any companies, organizations who work to collect all these small businesses and act on a bunch of like 100 companies instead of one company?
The question is, are there efforts to pool the small businesses? And absolutely, we're going to get to that in just a few minutes. When we get to some of the things states started to do to try and others try to do to try to get at some of these problems. Yes. The short answer is yes. We're going to talk about that. Okay. So what a number of states did in the mid-1990s, right after the Clinton debacle, states began turning their attention, as did the federal government, to a certain extent, to small group reform. And they created two kinds of reforms. One kind of reform was what they called an availability reform, trying to make health insurance more available people in the small group market, and the other kind of reform is an affordability reform, trying to make health insurance more affordable in the small group and individual market. Now, what do I mean by an availability reform? Well, there are people who historically, insurance companies have refused to insure. Just like if you have a record of, you know, 6 car crashes and 12 speeding tickets for the last year. Not my love, but if you had that record, it'd be pretty tough to get car insurance. You just couldn't get anybody to underwrite the insurance. Similarly, there were folks, and there are folks, who health insurers have refused to provide health insurance to in the past. Either because they worked in occupations that were considered to be high-risk occupations, or because they were sick, you know, and they had pre-existing conditions, they had cancer, they were sick and high. And the last thing in the world the insurance company would want to do is buy insurance to somebody who's actually sick. So there were people who really had trouble getting health insurance. So one of the things states began doing in the mid-90s were passing laws, for example, that were known as guaranteed issue laws. A guaranteed issue law is a law which basically says that an insurance company is required by state law to offer health insurance to everybody who wants it. They can't simply turn you away. Or guaranteed renewal laws. If you have health insurance with them and if you pay the premiums, they have to offer you a renewal of your policy. Or limits on the ability of insurance companies to exclude pre-existing conditions. If you got, you know, cancer, they can refuse to cover your cancer for the first 6 months you have it, or the first year you have it, but after that they have to cover it. All of these efforts to try to make health insurance available to people who previously couldn't get it. Just about every state in the country passed these kind of availability laws in the mid-90s. The trouble with the availability reforms is they don't make health insurance affordable. They simply say they have to sell you a policy. They don't say what price they have to sell you that policy. So maybe they have to sell you a policy, but they'll charge you an astronomical fee. So the second round and the tougher round that we're still dealing with today, in 2006, is how do you make health insurance, particularly in the small group market and the individual market, more affordable. Now, one idea that was just mentioned, the purchasing fees. There were a number of states that said, well, gee, why can't we just pool together all of these small businesses into one big pool, and so they could build up their leverage, they could spread their risk, they could reduce their administrative costs. It'll be great. And indeed, there's a lot of folks even today, not even today, 2006, who are pushing for purchasing pools as a vehicle. Now that's kind of what Clinton was talking about in 1993. Remember, Clinton was talking about having everybody join these health alliances, which would be a purchasing pool. But still today, a lot of people are talking about purchasing pools. The state of California created, the state of Kentucky created, a number of states created these small business purchasing pools. Now the trouble with the purchasing pools, though, historically has been, well, let me just ask you what you think, why you think enrollment in these pools has been lower than advocates would have hoped for. Any ideas? Well, the idea of the pool is, in theory, you're going to lower the cost for everybody by instead, I mean, even if you're a relatively low-cost eight-person firm, if you pull together a million relatively low-cost eight-person firms, in theory, your insurance rate should go down. Except you're 100% right in saying, well, let me put it differently. You're 100% right. I'll leave that part. But there's a real chicken and egg problem with a lot of these pools, which is that until you really have a lot of groups and a lot of individuals in the pool, you don't get the kind of leverage to lower costs. But until you really get lower costs, nobody wants to join the pool. So it's really, to a certain extent, been a chicken and egg problem. The pools haven't been able to draw enough people. And in fact, what California found was that 80% of the groups that joined the pool in California already provided health insurance to their employees. They were the small businesses that were providing health insurance to their employees, so they joined to get a lower rate. But very few of the groups that were not providing health insurance joined because the rate wasn't low enough for them, and they didn't get enough people to join up. Now, so when you're creating a pool from scratch, you really have a chicken and egg problem. What John Kerry, and in fact, if you look at Bush and Kerry during the last campaign, as I go through some of these ideas, I'll sort of talk about some of the current iterations of these as well. During the campaign, President Bush was advocating what he calls, and he's still today, advocating for what he calls association health plans. Basically, what he's saying is, I want to create these association health plans in which all these small businesses can join together and be free of all sorts of regulatory oversight and pull together. John Kerry also had a pooling approach in his, or suggestion in his campaign. Anybody know what Kerry's campaign platform around pools was? What he wanted? What he was proposing?
He said it
100 times over and over
that he wanted people to be able to buy into the same plan that he and Senator had.
So I have a question. He said it 100 times over and over again. Why are
we
the only one in the class?
Because I had a party every time there was a debate.
Okay. You're right. I mean, well, I don't know. I'm not going to be right about the party. But what Kerry was proposing, you're absolutely right, was that individuals and small businesses be allowed to join the federal employees' health benefit plan, which is a big pool of health insurance for federal employees. So he was saying the way we overcome the chicken and the egg problem is by letting people join in a big pool that's already pretty, there's 9 million people, I think, right now at the HCP. 8-9 million people, something like that. So let them, it's already got a big pool. So that was Kerry's proposal. So a lot of people are talking about pooling. but there have been very few, if any, successful pooling efforts to date. Obviously, Kerry has become president, his idea of buying into the NPHP has disappeared, gone nowhere. People talk about letting people buy into Medicare or Medicaid, simple state health plans, similar ideas. But what's really on the agenda these days, in Congress anyway, or association health plans, which you're not buying into a big pool, you're sort of creating sort of these organizations in which small businesses can pool together for better or worse. So one idea is pooling. What's another way you can make health insurance more affordable for small groups and individuals? Well, we mentioned one other actually before. Another is community rating. A number of states said, you know what, the reason health insurance is so expensive and there's so many uninsured is that people who are high risk, people can't afford to buy health insurance. So if we require community rating, it'll lower the cost for the high risk and it'll reduce the number of uninsured. Now, ironically and sadly, I suppose, in fact, what happens in a number of states, such as Kentucky, let me tell you the Kentucky story. Anybody here from Kentucky? I can take that one. In Kentucky, in the early 90s, they passed a really tough community rating law, one of the toughest in the country, and they passed a guaranteed issue law. So what do you think happened in the insurance market in Kentucky? 98% of the companies pulled out of the market and left the state, the small group market, because they said, we don't want to sell anymore in Kentucky. Large numbers of young, healthy folks who've been paying very low rates for health insurance because, you know, like Bill O'Reilly, they go to the gym every day and they're 25 years old and they're like you guys, so they don't pay much for health insurance. All of a sudden, their rates zoomed up because there was a community rating system and they were in effect being asked to now subsidize to the older, the unhealthy, and the sicker. So their rates zoomed up. So many of them decided they weren't going to pay those higher rates because they also knew that Kentucky had a guaranteed issue law and they had a really tough limit on the exclusion of pre-existing conditions so that they knew if they got sick, they could always get insurance at a community rate level, and if they had a pre-existing condition, there'd be a limited period of time that existing condition would be excluded by the insurance companies. So the rates of young folks in the market declined dramatically. You know, people, young folks in their 20s, 30s dropped out. Older folks who were really sick still often found that the community rate was too much for them to pay. Because it was still too high, you were at 150-200% of the poverty level to pay this community rate. So in fact, what happened in Kentucky, with the best of intentions, you know, legislators really thinking they were doing these great things to help the uninsured, they ended up with a health insurance market that was, you know, nearly empty of companies, with increased numbers of uninsured in the states, and with not that much aid to the high-risk uninsured. So a year or two later, they repealed the whole thing and they got started over from scratch. So it's very tough. You have to really be careful about unintended impacts and how these things are going to play out when you pass these laws. It's a very complicated situation. If you do community rating and you do guaranteed issues and you don't have an individual mandate, if it's a voluntary system in which you allow people to opt in and opt out, you could have trouble. But there are other states which have modified community rating, you know, in which you haven't had as adverse results as in Utah. So anyway, another thing you can do is community rating. What else can you do?
Is there a way you could give an incentive to the insurance company to take up small business?
Well, the best kind of incentive you can give to the insurance company is money. And there's a couple of ways you can make it more affordable so people can pay. We mentioned association health plans as one of the big features of the Bush plan. What else is Bush proposing? He's also proposing tax credits for individuals. You know, $1,000 for an individual, $3,000 whatever it is for a family. what Bush is saying is let's give tax credits to individuals so they can go out and buy a health insurance policy so they can afford it. Again, what's the trouble with tax credits, at least as you know, as articulated in this way? The people who typically do best under the tax credit are people who are already buying health insurance and now get a tax credit for it. So, I mean, you know, that's all fine and good, you know, to help out some person who is buying the individual small group market and give them a tax credit, but you're spending, you know, a not insignificant sum of federal dollars basically helping people who already have insurance. On the other hand, people who don't have insurance, if you give a family a $3,000 tax credit for a $12,000 policy, you know, that's probably not going to be enough or may not be enough to encourage or incentivize them to buy that policy. So there's a question as to whether or not tax credits, now if you give a $10,000 tax credit, then that'll clearly be enough. But then it would cost way too much money, according to Bush. And in fact, that would be the government buying the policy. The idea of the tax credit is to use a little bit of government money to leverage you as an individual, and it's tough to do that. So what's the Bush answer to that? Problem around tax credits. The Bush answer to that right now is to say what we ought to do is we ought to try to bring down the cost of health insurance by encouraging people to buy high deductible health insurance policies and to create and to buy health savings accounts. Because the theory, yeah, question.
Well, going along that line, if you give someone a tax credit, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to use it to purchase health insurance.
Well, presumably they have to in order to sign the tax credit. I mean, it's like you have to, you're not just given a $5,000 tax credit. You're given a $5,000 tax credit, and if you get audited, you better have a $3,000, you know, you better have a $3,000 bill. Now, that doesn't mean some people might not try to game the system and claim credit where it's not allowed to. But the theory is you're getting that tax credit for a health insurance policy. So what's a health savings account? Who knows what health savings
account is? Yeah. You put in a certain amount of money into this account, which can be used for buying a high deductible insurance. And I think it's like whatever you don't spend during the year, and health insurance you get to keep at the end of the year. So they're trying to get people to buy these high deductible insurance and also try to cut down costs of health care by trying to make them really get, you know, the value of every dollar that they spend on health care.
Right. The idea is, you buy a health insurance policy with, if you're an individual, like $1,000 or if you're a family, like $3,000 deductible. So that means, say your family, the first $3,000 of your health care costs, you're responsible for. So in theory, you know, it's much more, it's the cost of that insurance is going to be much lower. It's not going to be $12,000 per family, it's going to be significantly lower. You then, presumably, either you put into one of these health savings accounts or your employer puts into one of these health savings accounts, or you do it together. You have a choice. An amount equal to your deductible, or perhaps even a little bit more than your deductible. And you then, so that money goes to a health savings, in effect, a bank account. Then for your first, say, of the family, for the first $3,000 of medical bills that you incur, you pay for those bills out of this account. But say you don't incur bills, you just have the $3,000 in the account, you can actually, like an RRA or whatever, invest that money in a mutual fund or whatever you want, and it becomes sort of a way of, you know, sheltering some income. And you can carry it over from year to year. And at age 65, you can use the money on anything you want. It doesn't have to just be healthcare. So the theory is to make healthcare, health insurance more affordable by lowering the cost of insurance. The theory is it's also going to make you more cost conscious. If you're paying for that first $3,000 healthcare bill, you're not going to, in theory, you know, be as likely to go out and spend wildly, and you're going to be more prudent purchaser and prudent consumer, and you're going to want to know, you're going to want to use generics and not brand names and so on and so forth. So the idea is it's going to lower costs and it's going to help the uninsured. What critics say, yeah.
There are a lot of proposals that relate to making people more cost-conscious.
Absolutely.
Has there been research that shows that people are not cost-conscious with regard to healthcare?
Yes, there has. I mean, you know, when we talk about managed care, and we talk about what happened in health insurance markets, you know, there have been studies that show that if you have, you know, basically, prior to managed care in particular, if you had full health insurance that covered everything, you know, somebody, your employer is paying for your health insurance, and that health insurance covers all your health care bills, then the theory is neither you nor your doctor have any incentive to keep costs down, because basically everything is paid for. And in fact, there have been some studies that show once you impose co-pays on people, and premiums on people, and deductibles on people, they use less health care. Now, whether or not using less health care in that sense is good or bad is not at all clear. Because what people often do is the argument is they cut out some primary and preventive care. You know, they don't go for some of the basic upfront things, which actually could have long-term cost-saving benefits, but they cut some of those things out. Whereas the real big costs in healthcare are driven not by individuals. They are sort of the high-tech stuff driven by the catastrophic illnesses, you know, that people, you know, the cancers and the heart attacks and all the things that happen, you know, that, you know, you don't have choices about in that sense. But yes, I mean, it is the case that if you have totally, you know, generous health insurance, and your doctor knows that you know it, you know, this study that says you spend more. So there is a big movement these days toward what's known as consumer-directed healthcare. But there's a big debate as to whether our consumer-directed healthcare is going to really save money in the long term. And there's a big debate as to whether or not it's actually going to encourage people to not have to take advantage of healthcare that they really should be getting. So anyway, so what Bush is saying is, let's use these health savings accounts. Now what critics say is not only is this not going to save a lot of money, it's mainly going to be used, say the critics, as a way for wealthy and healthy people to shelter income. Because it becomes another tax shelter. You put the money away, you're relatively young and healthy, and then it's all tax-free, and it's sort of there, and you sort of can invest it. And what Bush proposed in his State of the Union address a couple of weeks ago was raising the amount of money you can contribute to these HSAs, you know, which again just makes it sort of a bigger tax shelter for people. But that's clearly one of the things that's on the agenda today, trying to make healthcare more affordable by moving toward a high deductible policy. What states did in the mid-90s, and what some states are still doing, is somewhat similar. What states were doing in the mid-90s was they were pushing what were known as bare-bones health policies. You know, basically trying to encourage people to buy sort of limited, catastrophic, bare-bones policies. Generally speaking, relatively few people were interested in buying bare-bones policies because what researchers found was that if you could afford a bare-bones policy, you actually could also probably afford a regular policy. The savings wasn't that much. And people didn't want bare-bones. If they were going to buy a policy, they actually would want sort of a regular policy. The idea of the HSA is to say, well, let's give you an incentive, a financial incentive to buy a bare-bones policy or a catastrophic policy.
For something like the HSAs, the company will be spending significantly less paying for the health care for the employees because now the insurance is very expensive. Will that translate into higher wages for people?
Nobody knows how this is going to play out. The comment was a company is going to save a lot of money through HSAs because they'll be contributing less. It's not clear what employers are going to do. The hope is, what the administration hopes, is that employers actually contribute to the HSAs a significant amount, not just buy, help the employee buy the high deductible policy, but also put some of the savings into the HSA, you know, contribute to the HSA, plus, you know, increase wages, perhaps. That's the theory, anyway. And big employers so far seem reluctant to contribute to HSAs, in part because one of the benefits that Bush is touting about the HSAs is that they're portable. So in other words, if you change jobs, you can take the HSA with you and the amount of money in that bank account with you. So employers are a little bit reluctant to contribute to a fund which you can then take with you to another employer. But nobody really knows how this is going to play out. There's about 3 million people right now who have bought qualifying high deductible plans. Only about 1.1 million of those people have started HSAs. You know, so people are buying the cheaper plans. Although if they don't start an HSA, that's probably people who can't afford to start the HSA. They're just buying the high deductible plan because it's cheaper. If they don't start the HSA, it's not clear what the benefits could be. There's only about 1 million people who have sort of legitimate health savings accounts right now in the country. You know, and there's about 180 million people who have employer-sponsored health insurance. So nobody really knows how this is going to play out. I mean, the speculation is it's going to be a limited market. I mean, probably some of the biggest fans of this market right now are Wall Street and banks. You've got banks that are actually starting health insurance companies, just like you have health insurance companies that are starting banks right now, because you know, the health insurance companies want to be able to start HSAs and sort of have their own banks that people could deposit them in, and the banks want to start health insurance companies. So it's not quite clear how that's all going to play out. Yeah.
So it's like all the savings in managed care and HMOs that, you know, basically took healthcare dollars in, they weren't passed on to the consumer. They were passed on to the insurance company, right? Like all the money that...
So there wasn't that much money that was actually saved by managed care, but we'll get to that.
But insurance companies made more. Like, we didn't get anything. We just got co-pays. The doctors didn't make more.
Right. I mean, the theory was that when managed care seemed to be holding premium increases down, employers paid less for insurance. So the rate of increase for premiums went down. Whether or not that translated into higher wages for employees is a very complicated question that, you know, the economists face. They actually set it in the law. I mean, there's minimums. Here, let's see. I'm not going to give you the right amount.
I guess I'm asking because would ever someone see that goal be so high that they actually wouldn't spend that much on health care here and then hopefully wouldn't be healthy? Like, if your deductible is down and out, and you get
$10,000
in health care?
If your deductible, I mean, the theory is, particularly if you're young and healthy, you know, so for an individual, you have to deduct at least, your deductible has to be for an individual $1,050. For a family, it has to be $2,100. That's the minimum. It'd be higher. The higher the deductible, the lower the policy is going to be, the lower the cost of the policy. The theory is, you're an individual and you buy a policy with a $1,500 deductible. The theory is you take that $1,500 and you put it in one of these HSAs. And so you then use, in theory, the HSA to pay for that first $1,500 in health care, which the insurance company won't cover. But if you don't spend $1,500 in health care, you go to the doctor once for your annual checkup, costs $75, and that's your only bill for the whole year, then you've got $1,425 in that bank account that rolls over to the next year.
But you still purchase the health insurance plan.
Right, but the health insurance plan is a lot cheaper because you purchased a high deductible health insurance plan. Well, yeah, you didn't use it, right. You never filed a claim. I mean, you used it in the sense that insurance is there in case something happens to you. It's just like you use your car insurance if you don't have an accident. But you never filed a claim, right? Yeah.
But I think it's important to note that, like, the kinds of things that are included in, like, healthcare costs that are included in your $1,500 or whatever that you can spend are not necessarily things that would be covered by a regular insurance plan. Like, if you go downtown, there's, like, the Versace eyewear store, and they're like, spend your HSA dollars here before the tax year is over. And, like, would a person with a regular insurance policy spend $800 on a pair of glasses? Like, maybe not. They might.
Well, where you particularly see that is not so much in HSA. You see a little bit in HSA. You see a lot of that flexible spending accounts. The flexible spending accounts, and again, this is sort of technical language, but the flexible spending accounts are accounts where you put money away pre-tax to pay for health care costs that are not covered by insurance, but you lose it at the end of the year. So if you put away $1,000 and it's December 28th and you've only spent $200 on health care that year, you're going to lose that $800 unless you spend it before December 31st. So there are an awful lot of people. I mean, there are, you know, you have people go to the ophthalmologist, you have people go and get a new pair of glasses or whatever, just because they want to spend that money. And that's clearly the case. The HSA, there's a little less incentive for you to have to do that since you can carry the money over for the next year. Yeah.
I'm confused about what happens when the money's out. You just put more money in, or if you put money into your HSA, somehow something has happened and it costs more than what?
Well, say you have a deductible of $2,000, and say you put $2,000 in your HSA, and say you have health care costs of $3,000. You spend your $2,000 in your HSA. You've then exhausted the deductible, and then your insurance policy kicks in and pays the rest.
I'm not usually at 100%.
Well, whatever insurance policies pay. And there's so many issues. I mean, you're so brand new. I mean, for example, when you're paying out of your HSA, you're supposed to be able to pay at the same rate that your insurance company pays. You're supposed to have the same charges for doctor's visits and drugs and everything else. A lot of doctors and a lot of drug companies haven't figured out a lot of people end up paying higher rates. So there's a lot of things that still have to be worked out about HSA. And I don't know, I'm not personally a fan of them, but I'm not sure how well they're going to take off or not. But one thing that they really do, I think the argument that, to me, the most compelling argument, let me put it this way, in my view, from an individual's point of view, from the point of view perhaps of one of you as a student in this class, for a 28-year-old, healthy, young, person, an HSA might actually be in your individual interest. It might actually make sense economically for you to buy, a high deductible plan and put that money in an HSA, as opposed to if you have a young family, if you're 28, your wife's 28, you have a couple of young kids, as opposed to paying $14,000 for a family policy, if you don't have one from your employer, you might be better off getting an HSA. On the other hand, what that does, and to me this is the biggest problem with HSAs, what that does is it fragments even more the insurance market. It takes the healthiest and the wealthiest and the folks out of the insurance market, the traditional insurance market, and it puts sort of healthy, wealthy folks, what's good for them, in this pool over here, and it leaves behind everybody else. So the costs for everybody else go up. And to me what that does is it fragments and it decentralizes and it breaks down the principles of social insurance and coverage of everybody. And so that, I think, is the most compelling criticism of the HSAs. On the other hand, it depends on what your views are on these things. I mean, if you think, well, as an individual, and as a family member, I should be doing what's best for my family, maybe you should get one of these things. I'm not talking about you. I mean, I'm saying, the question becomes, as a government, though, is it a policy, should government be encouraging the young and the healthy to sort of pull their money out, or should government be encouraging the young and the healthy to pool together in a more sort of social insurance, social solidarity way? I mean, that's what the debate is really about, yeah.
So, under this sort of plan, when you went to the doctor's office, would you be immediately responsible for that money? Like, how would the physician's office collect that money from you before your deductible? Is it like a thing where you have to,
what a lot of insurance companies with these plans are doing is they're urging people not to pay the doctor right away. Because, the doctor may insist on paying it right away. And if the doctor insists on payment right away, it could be that the doctor could be overcharging. What the insurance company is suggesting is that you submit a claim to the insurance company. They'll deny the claim because you have to make the deductible, but they'll also tell you the value of what they would have, how much of the deductible is being eaten up by that claim. That we would have paid $74 for the doctor, so this $74 being applied to your deductible. And then you should write a check to your doctor for $74. That's the amount that he or she really is due under that insurance policy. A lot of doctors may just charge you their standard rate for the uninsured and, not an insurance rate, which is wrong. They shouldn't be doing that. But how that actually is playing out, I'm really not sure. All right, what else? So we talked about a few things. Let me just run through a few other efforts to try to make health insurance more affordable in the private market. Here in New York, yes. Go ahead. I was just about to talk about reinsurance. That's like, I mean, go ahead. I'm so happy. But I mean, you're definitely on the right track there, and reinsurance is definitely something that states are looking to do. Anybody here in New York hear the program called Health in New York?
Yeah.
I mean, Health in New York is now considered this model program that people around the country are looking at. Health in New York has a reinsurance component. What Health in New York does is, insurance companies that sell in the small group market are required by New York law to participate in Health in New York. They have to sell a product in Health in New York. But the cost of the product is relatively affordable, so the argument goes. And the reason it's relatively affordable is that the state of New York is saying and says to Health in New York that we will pay the insurance company for claims between $5,000 and $75,000. Between $5,000 and $75,000. So if Jane Doe buys from Health in New York and ends up in the hospital and has a $25,000 hospital bill, the insurance company only has to pay $5,000 of that hospital bill. New York State pays $20,000 of that hospital bill. New York State reinsures, in effect acts as if it's Lloyd's of London or something, and reinsuring. New York State reinsures the insurance company against catastrophic loss. And so because New York State is reinsuring the insurance company, since it doesn't have to worry about some of those higher cost bills, the cost of the insurance comes down. That's Health in New York. I speak with John Kerry at the debate parties. Did he discuss the reinsurance plan too? Come on. John Kerry was proposing a reinsurance plan for the country. He was proposing that the federal government act as a reinsurer for private health insurance. The idea was that would lower the cost of private health insurance, that would make it more affordable for people to be able to buy private health insurance. And the idea is this. But there's a relatively few folks who cost a heck of a lot of money, who end up driving up costs for everybody else, so the argument goes. You know, people in their last, 6 months of their life, their last 2 months of their life, their last 24 hours of their life, you know, there's all this heroic, high-tech stuff that's done that costs a fortune. So the idea is, if you could, in effect, take out some of the catastrophic, some of the high-cost stuff, the cost of insuring everything else would be much less. So that was going to cost the government a lot of money to do that. So one of the things that Bush was complaining about during the debate was that how is Kerry going to pay for this reinsurance package? It's going to cost tens of billions of dollars and so on and so forth. But New York does it in Healthy New York, and other states are looking at Healthy New York and looking at reinsurance as a way of making health insurance more affordable. Now, it is true that Health in New York is an interesting model. It is true that Kerry proposed it as well. It is true that other states are looking at it. On the other hand, there's only about 100,000 people who signed up for Health in New York so far, despite all of the great publicity. And at least that was about a year ago. It's probably a few more now. But, you know, it hasn't taken off quite as much as people thought it would take off. And again, part of the problem is reinsurance brings down the cost of insurance, but whether it brings it down enough to make it affordable, somebody at 200% of the poverty level who's working for Joe's Pizzeria is not at all clear. All of these ideas, there's a lot of ideas as to how to make health insurance more affordable. You know, for Joe's Pizzeria, there's reinsurance. We talk about premium assistance programs with Medicaid. When we do Medicaid, there's tax credits. There's purchasing tools, there's bare bones policies, community rating, there's high risk pools. I mean, there's all of these things. Let me see my notes if I forgot any of them. I mean, there's all these kind of things. So it doesn't matter if I forgot. But the problem is, the experience of the states, anyway, in the mid-90s, was that while these various approaches lower the cost of insurance, perhaps, they don't seem to lower it enough to make it affordable to the uninsured. Does that mean that these programs haven't helped people? Of course not. Does that mean that there's not 100,000 people in health in New York, you know, who are much better off than they were previously? Of course they are. Does that mean that states should abandon these approaches? Of course not. But it does mean that these approaches have not been able to effectively get at the larger problem of the uninsured, because at the same time Healthy New York is going on, the number of uninsured in New York is escalating at a far more rapid pace than Healthy New York enrollment is growing. I mean, as I said, in the last 5 years, we've gone up 5 million people, 5 million uninsured folks just in the last 5 years. Some of that up here.
The reinsurance program, is it people that benefit them, or insurance companies, or employers?
In New York, under Healthy New York? I mean, under Healthy New York, that's an option that's available, you know, HMOs are required to sell a product at Healthy New York. You know, so they're required to participate. So they sell a product. The state basically accepts the benefit package. Small businesses, self-employed individuals, and low-wage workers, low-wage, you know, folks with low income, are allowed to buy a premium. It's a voluntary individual program that either you or your small business can buy. General Motors can buy at Healthy New York. Small businesses can. So it's an option for small businesses to self-employed. It can be a company. Oh no, Healthy New York is, I mean, there's some sort of nonprofit, I mean, I think it's a state administered nonprofit that runs it. But it's basically a state run program. Who actually administers it, I'm not even 100% sure. But it's there's a website, there's a healthy, you know, there is an administrative entity that administers it. I'm not even 100% sure who it is. Healthy New York. You have to choose to buy the Healthy New York product. And that was as of a year or so ago. They may be a little bit higher now. Okay, so let me sort of step back for a minute. We've been talking. When it comes to helping the uninsured, I think there are basically four global kind of strategies you can think about. One of those strategies we've just been talking about, one of those strategies is to try to make health insurance more affordable, more available in the private market. And make private health insurance more available to people. So you could try to do tax credits, you could try to do reinsurance, you could try to do HSAs, you could try to do community rating, you could try to do bare bones health policies. You could impose an employee mandate. You could impose an individual mandate with an accompanied with tax credits. You know, there's a whole host of things you could do, but the idea is this global strategy is to keep the private insurance system in place and to try to make that private insurance system more available and more affordable to more people. That's one kind of strategy. Okay? A second kind of strategy is to expand the use of publicly funded health insurance. Now, at one extreme, that would mean, you know, the federal government adopting a single-payer, Canadian-style national health care system, Medicare for All. I mean, that would be expanding the public system. More incrementally, that would mean the Medicaid expansions that we talked about in the late 80s, where the number of people on Medicaid went up, you know, from 20 million to 40 million, and now there's 52 million, you know, trying to add people to the Medicaid rolls. Another thing that Kerry was proposing in his campaign for president was that Medicaid rolls be significantly expanded and increased. How much going to Medicaid be significantly expanded and increased. So we talked about Medicare last week. I said some people, when they have the surplus, are saying, let's let people buy into Medicare, you know, let's lower the Medicare age to 55 or 60. Let's use Medicare. The state of Illinois, anybody here from Illinois? Okay, what's Illinois done recently, you know?
No idea.
The governor of Illinois recently got the legislature to pass a program called the Covering All Kids Initiative. Well, I think it's called something like that. Something like Covering All Kids. Which becomes effective in July of 2006. And as of July of 2006, every uninsured kid in the state of Illinois will be able to buy into this new public program that the state has on a sliding scale basis. So presumably the argument is it's going to be affordable on a short term, on a sliding scale basis. And what Illinois and the governor claims is that it's basically going to eliminate uninsurance, or should eliminate uninsurance among kids in the state of Illinois as a result of this program. We'll have to see how the program plays out. But Illinois is a national leader on that. So it could be a Medicaid expansion, it could be a Medicare expansion, it could be a single payer system, it could be Illinois program to try to provide health insurance for uninsured kids, or it could be what Congress did in 1997, which was enact a new program called the State Child Health Insurance Program, or the SCHIP program. A lot of these programs focus on kids. Remember I said in the mid-90s, there were two groups that policymakers focused on. One was the small business community, for all the reasons we just talked about, and all the ways we just talked about. And the other group has been kids. Why kids? Why so much attention to kids? Because unhealthy kids become unhealthy adults. Because kids are politically popular. Absolutely, they're a sympathetic group. Yep. Because they're a lot cheaper, you know, on a per capita basis.
No one argues that they're not deserving for it. It's not their fault. They're born to families.
They're a very deserving group. You know, you don't want to cast the sins of the parents on the kids. In fact, we as a country come as close as we come. We have never said that there's a right to health insurance in the United States, that citizens have a right to health insurance or health care. We come as close as we come to that statement around not all kids, but little kids. I'll tell you where kids get complicated and where the political consensus breaks down around kids. It's when they enter the damn teen years. when we start talking about, you know, giving 13, 14, 15-year-old girls access to, you know, family plan and birth control services. But when you start talking about giving 14, 15-year-old kids access to substance abuse treatment, then this notion of kids is sort of cute little, deserving, you know, folks who we want to just help begins to break down. And so a lot of the consensus around kids really has to do with, you know, cute little ones who are really cheap, who everybody agrees should have their immunizations, you know, it makes sense to have their immunizations to take care of them. You know, you could say even if they don't have health insurance, they can show up at, you know, health department clinics or someplace and get certain things taken care of. So for all of those reasons, and I'm actually quite serious when I say a lot of consensus breaks down around teens. And the number of uninsured teens is significantly higher than the number of uninsured four-year-olds. Eligibility rates are much higher for younger kids. Outreach is much more extensive, and on. And really, sort of the whole debate around deservingness becomes much more complicated as I say, as the parents of a 17 to 20-year-old. But in 1997, Congress, in a bipartisan fashion, passed the State Child Health Insurance Program, which provided roughly $40 billion over 10 years to the states. For the states to use, in effect, as a block grant, each state got a block set amount of money over that 10-year period coming up for reauthorization next year. We've got a block amount of money to use to provide health insurance coverage to kids and families with incomes too high for Medicaid, but too low to afford private insurance. Big boost, another big boost in health insurance among kids in the late 90s. Another 3-4 million kids covered as a result of the SCHIP program. Remarkably, in the late 1990s, as a result of the Medicaid expansions and then as a result of CHIP, and as a result also of the fact that in the late 90s the economy was in pretty good shape and the employer market has sort of stabilized, the rate for the uninsured in the United States declined in 1990 and 2000. We had fewer uninsured in 2000 than we did in 1999. Ever since then, however, the rates have been going up about 1 million a year. It was a short-term blip downward. SCHIP, though, is another clear example of a public expansion for a politically popular group. So one strategy is to try to expand private insurance through the ways we talked about. A second strategy is to try to expand publicly funded insurance in the ways we've just talked about. A third strategy, and this is actually related to the public insurance one, a third strategy is to say, you know what? There are probably 8 to 10 million Americans who are eligible for public insurance programs right now, but who are not enrolled, either because they don't know they're eligible, or because it's too much of an administrative hassle for them to sign up, or because they think there's a stigma attached to being enrolled, or because they're worried about their immigration status. You know, for a host of reasons, there's millions, literally millions of folks who are eligible to unenroll. There was a big effort in the late 90s to sign a lot of those folks up in the early 2000s. Not just at the government level, but the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation had a program called the Covering Kids Program. It's a pretty good program. I'm actually on the National Advisory Committee for that program, so I probably went to about 30 states over a few-year period looking at their Covering Kids programs. You know, pretty interesting efforts in a lot of these states around the country to sort of sign up and enroll, to sort of do outreach, to do education, to do administrative simplification, to do a whole lot of community-based enrollment, all these kinds of things. So even today, in 2006, there's still millions who are eligible but unenrolled. So that's a third kind of strategy. A fourth kind of strategy is to basically say, you know what? No matter what kind of insurance you have, yeah, or program you have, the question.
I didn't really get
I got a little less clear. The strategy is basically to say, you know what, politically, it's very tough to talk about going to the New York State Legislature, or politically, it's very tough to talk about going to Congress and say, let's expand eligibility for Medicaid. Let's expand eligibility for Medicare. Let's create a new CHIP program. Politically, it's very tough to do that. However, a lot of people say, you know, you don't have to do that right now. Just based on current eligibility levels, instead of spending our time and our political capital and our energy and our effort trying to convince recalcitrant legislatures to expand eligibility to programs, let's focus instead right now on the fact that there are 10 million folks out there who are already eligible for programs that have already been enacted and have not signed up for them. And let's get those people signed up first and worry about expanding criteria later. Does that make sense? I really didn't mean to, fourth kind of strategy is to basically say, you know, insurance isn't everything, and we're never going to be able to cover everybody. And so what we ought to do instead is to try to build up the medical safety net. We ought to give more money to community health centers. You ought to give more money to public hospitals. We ought to give more money to health department clinics. We ought to basically say to the medical safety net, you treat whoever walks in the door. You're doing it already. You're going bankrupt. Here, we're going to subsidize. Instead of worrying about trying to get an insurance card in everybody's hand, let's try to create and build up the medical clinics and the medical community that services the uninsured and low-income population. Again, the Bush administration has been taking, this has been one of the leading strategies of the Bush administration. There has been a tremendous infusion of dollars over the last 5 years in community health centers around the country. The number of Americans served by community health centers around the country has gone from about 9 million to about 16 million in the last 4 or 5 years. Every year, the federal government in the last 4 or 5 years has given another 10-15% increase in federal funding to community health centers. There's been a boom in community health centers around the country. And in a bipartisan way, that's been happening. Now, again, there's big debates, pros and cons, on whether or not building up the safety net is really the way to help the uninsured. Some people say you're just exacerbating and creating a two-tier healthcare system, you know, one tier for the poor, one tier for everybody else. Some people say, well, you know, the safety net can do certain things for people, but it doesn't have access to the specialists, it doesn't have the prescription drugs, you know, it doesn't, can't give comprehensive care. There's a back and forth, but clearly a very different kind of strategy is to say, let's not worry so much about insurance and insurance expansion, and let's worry a little bit more about healthcare services to low-income populations in clinics, whether it's school-based clinics, health centers, or wherever. Very different kinds of approaches. Obviously, you can mix and match. You know, these are not, this is sort of an artificial way to sort of divvy up a whole range of different kinds of strategies. But you can look at, I mean, so for example, Bush, what's Bush talking about? He's talking about health savings accounts, he's talking about association health plans, he's talking about community health centers, he's talking about tax credits, you know, sort of small tax credits. That's the Bush health plan right now. And medical malpractice, you know, sort of using medical malpractice to form lower costs a little bit. Kerry was talking about reinsurance. Kerry was talking about people buying into the federal employees' health benefit plan, and he's talking about expanding Medicaid and SHIP in a significant way, you know, expansion to public insurance. I make it seem like those are two, you know, two different plans. Kerry's was much more geared toward sort of publicly funded, government-driven solutions, spending a pretty fair amount of government dollars. Bush's is much more designed for sort of a market-based approach, in which you use a little bit, a very little bit, of government money to try to leverage the private sector activity. They're very fundamentally different approaches. Fundamentally different approaches. But different folks have their own ideas. And what you're going to do, again, let me just say one more thing about these policy memos. In the memo itself, I really want you to both fairly and articulately lay out some of the options, but then really wear the hat of whatever hat I've asked you to wear to come up with a realistic strategy for that group. That's the memo. You'll then have a chance in a small group to say what you think should be done. But the goal of the memo isn't for you to say what you think should be done. It's for you to say in sort of clear form, I work for an organization, this is the organization's agenda, and here's how we get from A to B. There's no class next week. We'll meet back here on the 27th. I would really prefer with 230 people in the class, it becomes impossible if you all try to email me papers. So I really prefer hand in on the 27th, at the beginning of the class, a hard copy of your 5-6 paper. Have a great President's Day. I'll see you in a couple weeks.
That should be easy.
Yeah.
Ship all the pork to
water.
Thank you.